Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, Lifirth, Utopia, streetcars, liquor laws, the BLM, so much more. And joining me this morning, Tribune government reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, great to have you. Thank you so much.
Good morning. Thank you.
Chris Smart, who covers Salt Lake City Hall. Chris, hi there.
Hi, Jennifer.
And real estate and business reporter Tony Semerad. Welcome back, Tony.
Hello there.
And you can join us too. What headlines grabbed you this week? You can send your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+. You can put them in the comments section of our website at sltrib.com, or you can call us. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Robert, I'll start with you. This week, LA Clippers owner Don Sterling, of course, got the boot for some racist statements that he made. And closer to home, State Representative David Lifirth chimed in on the controversy on Twitter, got into some hot water. What happened?
Well, Representative Lifirth is a sort of a pugnacious Twitterer. He kind of engages in the scrum a little bit. And so he tweeted that that we should have known that Don Sterling was racist when he gave money to the NAACP, which kind of sort of sparked this little flare up on Twitter. People were questioning what he meant by that. And he followed it up essentially saying, well, any organization that caters to one particular, caters to people based on their skin color is racist. So he was essentially saying the organization was racist. He defended that in some back and forth during the evening. The NAACP president, Janetta Williams, obviously said it was, she disagreed with it, called it an ignorant statement.
Said he needed to be schooled.
Said he needed to come to one of their meetings and they could school him on what the organization is and what it does. The next day, you know, there wasn't a lot of people sticking up for him. He posted some emails he got, including one from a state legislator supporting his comments, but you know, the sense was that it, you know, this was out of line. I think broadly held sense was this was out of line. And so last night in the evening, he posted on his blog that an apology, saying that, you know, it was an insensitive joke, and he you know, felt bad about it. He took down the tweets.
Janetta, couple days after the fact.
Couple
though.
Days, yeah. It was 2 days after. It was kind of funny because he had called himself in an earlier blog post. He called himself a hero of the civil rights movement because when he was a kid, he was in the first grade, and they integrated his school in Tennessee. But he did, you know, to his credit, I think, retracted his statement and apologized for any hurt feelings. Janetta Williams spoke with her last night, and she said, you know, it was an unfortunate incident, obviously, but she you know, accepted the apology and hopes that they can move forward.
Mm. You say the reaction among political insiders is, you know, step away from the situation.
they took cover, I think, a little bit. I mean, you know, people didn't really want to talk about it. One of the comments we got was from Mia Love's campaign. Mia Love running for Congress, she would be the first black female Republican in Congress. And so her campaign, you know, essentially said, we don't agree with this. They've Representative Lifirth is a supporter of hers, but they haven't seen anything that would indicate that he's racist, but they don't agree with the statements, and they kind of distance themselves. Nobody else would really comment on it. The party was took a no comment approach. The governor's office was a no comment. The speaker didn't return phone calls. So, you know, he was sort of an island out there. But he retracted the statements yesterday evening. It was sort of a contrast, I think, to when Chris Butters had a similar flare up a few years back, and he kind of ended up throwing gas on the fire by, you know, saying that there was a lynch mob out to get him, which just sort of compounded it even further. I suspect this may be blowing over. Representative Lifirth does not have a Democratic challenger. There's a independent American candidate who's running against him, but he's, you know, probably pretty safe in that district despite the adverse press coverage in the last few days.
Even though he was in sort of the political doghouse, I mean, nobody was rebuking him very vocally.
No. It did get a little bit of national attention, you know, I think Huffington Post and Talking Points, you know, a couple more with progressive publications, online publications, paid attention to it. But yeah, there wasn't a strong condemnation for it out of either party. I mean, let me take that back. The Democratic Party said he was doubling down on dumb, which was kind of a funny comment.
Predictably,
they're gonna take a shot at him, and this is kind of Representative Lifford's track record a little bit too, because he has, you know, he's frequently posting stuff on Twitter about challenging climate science, about whether there's a consensus on climate change and global warming. Every time it snows, it seems like he posts something like, thanks global warming for the snow, you know. He's referred to gay groups that are pro-gay groups that do boycotts and sort of things as the Gestapo, you know, which people took offense at. You know, you're comparing gay rights groups to Nazis. It's maybe pushing the envelope. But he's never backed down from any of this before. And so this was sort of for him to, reconsider and recant, I think, was a change of pace for him.
Mm. Well, I guess if there is a winner, it's the NAACP. They got a message out.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of an unfortunate situation all around. Considering the whole, from the start with the Dawn Sterling comments and everything. But yeah, I mean, the NAACP got its message out that it has broad support and reaches across the political spectrum, I guess. It this may not be a lingering long-term issue, I guess. Mm-hmm. Maybe an isolated flare-up.
Mm-hmm. Other issue happening in state government this week was the liquor laws. A new state law will go into effect in July, making it legal to buy and sell those very coveted club licenses. How's it going to work?
Well, it's the concept, I guess, is that, there's a market for these, and so we're going to allow them to be sold back and forth between club owners. You know, if you have one now, you can sell it to somebody who wants to open a club. It's going to be regulated. I mean, the Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control is still going to have to review and approve these. The thinking is they could be worth an awful lot of money, because the state has created this sort of scarcity for these licenses, and now they're creating a market for these licenses to be sold back and forth. The idea, Senator Valentine, who sponsored the bill, said that these are being traded or sold anyway. He just wants to bring it under sort of a little bit more state supervision, I guess, more supervision of this board. They're still kind of working through the mechanics of how this is going to work, and they've got they're running out of time a little bit, I guess, but the law doesn't take effect till July 1st. The thinking is, though, that with the club licenses for bars and clubs are the toughest to get. Mm-hmm. And there's a long waiting list. There's a lot of people who want to get these. The thinking is, if you've got one of these, it could be worth an awful lot of money. One of the caveats is that if you buy one, if you have a license, you have to use it within 30 days, because they don't want you getting a license, sticking it in your pocket while the value of it goes up, and, creating a bidding war and then selling it just to make money.
That actually was my next investment opportunity, but oh well.
Right. Put all your money in plastics and liquor licenses.
Yeah, 30 days is not going to happen. So if your bar isn't doing so well, you can sell your license to somebody else, make a bit of cash. Legislators did sidestep the alcohol reform issue this past session for the most part. Mm-hmm. Any appetite to reenact any other reforms, expand the club license base so there's more of them? What about getting rid of the Zion curtain? Yeah. Are you hearing anything on the legislative front?
We're probably still waiting for the dust to settle a little bit from the last session. I think with one of the key movers on liquor issues in the House, Ryan Wilcox, he left the legislature to go work for Senator Mike Lee, and you've still got Senator Valentine on the Senate side. I think my sense right now is that there's probably the legislators kind of want to wait and see how these other changes play out. There might be some minor tweaks on the fringe on the margins, but as far as major reform, I still get the sense that there's not an appetite there for that. But things could change in the next 6 months before the legislature's back in session.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporters Robert Gerke, Chris Smart, and Tony Semerad about the week's headlines. And if you want to join us, call us. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. You can send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk or put your comments at sltrib.com. Let's move on to the capital city. A lot happening this week, Chris Smart. Now that the Sugar House streetcar is up and running, Mayor Ralph Becker wants to expand that vision. What is the vision for streetcars in the city?
Well, the vision is we're going to be a streetcar city someday. But, you know, these things are expensive. They're, you know, $25 million a mile. However, the Becker administration is looking into the future, you know, 30 years. We expect a huge population increase. That means we're going to need transportation alternatives to the automobile. It also means that we can look forward to more densely populated areas in the urban zone.
Why does he say streetcars? Why not more buses or I don't know, alternatives?
Well, that's an excellent question, and what it's about, buses is about transportation, period. Streetcars are about transportation and economic development, and that is because bus routes can come and go, but once you lay that rail down, it's there. And so as we look across the country to cities like Portland, Oregon, and others, you can see that the streetcar lends itself to economic development. So and they're sort of bearing the brunt of this in Sugar House right now when they put in that the only line we have now, the S line, which actually doesn't really function a lot like a streetcar yet because it's on an old railway right-of-way. But there's a proposal in Sugar House that would increase building densities and take buildings to 105 feet tall. Well, the people in the neighborhood there are beside themselves because even though they want a streetcar, they didn't have this notion in the back of their minds that that meant, you know, that their little wonderful little Sugar House neighborhoods were going to be all of a sudden engulfed by a high-density urban zone.
Mm-hmm. The city council got a peek at this vision this week. What did they think?
Mixed signals, mixed reviews. They sort of knew it was coming because this has been sort of on the drawing board in one form or another since 2010. And during that time, the transportation staff at the city has been analyzing various components of what would make a streetcar successful, where we want to see these transportation corridors, what we expect in those neighborhoods. And so they unveiled it, and two of the council members really liked it. And, you know, the rest of them either didn't like it or had serious questions about it. Mm. And part of the reason, I think, for that is because when UTA went on its light rail spree and laid huge amounts of track for light rail, they cut back bus service in the city, and people are clamoring for that. Mm. So the council is, you know, wants to get more immediate service, and they have concerns about, you know, is this the right place for this? And that's going to all be worked out. Meantime, however, the Sugar House line it's only the first phase has been completed. It hasn't really gone out onto Highland Drive and 11th East, where it would actually function as a streetcar in traffic. So for most Salt Lakers, you know, a streetcar is an unknown. And I think the general public looks to transportation as a solution for what's happening today. And I think what the planners don't tell them is that rail, particularly streetcars, is really something that is going to take us into the future. And it once you change the transportation dynamic, you change everything. So you can look at Main Street before tracks and after tracks. And what you see there is two different Main Streets.
Sure. But streetcars are the pricey option. How is Becker proposing to pay for it? Because that affects the here and now.
Well, you had to ask. well, Salt Lake City is applying for a federal grant for the next phase of the Sugar House streetcar. For this downtown streetcar that was unveiled, the plan was unveiled Tuesday, there has been no funding identified.
Does that mean I have to pay?
Well, Councilman Kyle Amalfa has some interesting ideas about this, how that he thinks that it's possible for the city to pay for the streetcar from those property owners who would benefit from it. Now, how that shakes out, I'm not sure, but, you know, City Hall has been able to work strange magic with budgets and numbers. I mean, all you have to do is look at the Utah Performing Arts Center. And so we don't know, but their idea is this. We cannot just sit here and wait. We have to start. It takes a long time to build a streetcar. And so we need to plan now and get moving now, because we need to get these things in place. And they're talking, they're looking 30 years down the road.
And or the rail line, as it were.
Yes, for rail. In the interim, people want to get around. And the easiest way to implement that kind of a transportation system is through buses. So you have this push and pull going.
Hmm. Well, it'll be interesting to see how Becker sort of navigates that with the council. Salt Lake Tribune reporters Chris Smart, Robert Gerke, and Tony Semerad are with me. And we're talking behind the headlines here on KCPW. You can join us as well. The number, 801-355-TALK. Send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Joining me this hour, Tribune reporters Tony Semerad, Chris Smart, and Robert Gerke. And now on the line, Kristen Moulton, who covers, gosh, Kristen, you cover pretty much everything, right?
Kind of a pinch hitter, I think.
Joining us on the line, Kristen, thank you so much for your time. You can join us as well by sending a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. You can put your comments at sltrib.com. Or you can give us a call, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Kristen, I want to bring you in to talk about the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management. Been in the headlines a lot this week. That's the federal agency that manages public lands here in Utah and across the nation. Let's talk first about the wild horse issue going on in southern Utah. I guess ranchers say there are too many wild horses, and the BLM is not taking care of the problem. You were down in Iron County last week. Describe the situation.
Yeah, that's precisely it. The ranchers say it's that the range is getting overrun by wild horses. Their numbers, if they are not removed, increase every 4 years, or double every 4 years. So the BLM, which has been hamstrung by lack of funding and lack of places to put all the wild horses they do capture, has not been holding all the roundups that would keep them in check. And even it acknowledges that fact. The BLM has limits that it sets on how many horses the ecology there can sustain, so that all the multiple uses, the livestock, the wildlife, the recreationists all have a good landscape. And their limits for Millard and Iron County add up to about 600 horses over 9 different herd management areas. And I've been piecing together different communications and environmental assessments and whatnot, and have learned the BLM itself admits they're like 3 times as many horses right now on the range.
How many horses are we talking about, Kristen?
In that area, there's supposed to be 600, and there are at least 1,800.
Wow.
For some ranchers in One Iron County, or the Beaver County Commissioner claims there, you know, he guarantees there are 4,000 out there. So, you know, I don't know about that. The wild horse advocates, of course, say no, there are a lot fewer, and the range damage is really caused by the livestock, not by the wild horses. So, of course, there are disputes over that. But so anyway, the county commissioners, fueled by ranchers' anger, are talking about rounding up the horses if the BLM won't come July when the mares are done foaling. And the BLM Utah manager, Juan Palma, is proposing two roundups, even though his superiors in Washington have said there will be no roundups this year. They don't have any place to put these horses. So he's proposing two roundups that would total, about 1,000 horses out there. And then this week, the ranchers who have formed a new group are suing the BLM and the Interior Secretary, demanding that the BLM do its job and bring the horses within the range the BLM says should be out there. They're not suggesting all the horses be killed. They just want the BLM to stick with the limits that it has said should be out there.
A bit of a mess.
It's a bit of a mess, and it's not the only one for the BLM in Utah. There are other flashpoints going on right now, and a lot of this, you know, a lot of the confrontational mood in rural Utah is because people feel emboldened after the Cliven Bundy thing down in Nevada. The BLM, which was trying to execute a court order, backed down after Bundy's armed supporters showed up, and so the BLM is seen as weak right now. So there are other flashpoints coming.
Okay, well, let's back to the horse plan. The public can comment on the BLM horse plan. How do they do that?
Yeah, they can comment on, there's only one environmental assessment so far posted. Another one should be out in a few days. But anyway, they can go to the BLM environmental bulletin board and find the address to write to or the email address to write to. Or they can go on the Salt Lake Tribune. The story that had 2 days ago, or I guess it ran in the print edition yesterday, there's a little box that also tells people where they can write
okay.
to comment.
So that's
on
the one
those
issue.
Proposed roundups, which may not be approved by Washington in any case. It may all be an exercise.
Oh, boy. Okay, you mentioned other clashes. There was one scheduled for next week. A group of ATV riders wanted to ride, stage a protest, I guess, through Recapture Canyon. Where is this, and what are they protesting?
It's a canyon just to the east of Blanding. Apparently, generations of Blanding residents have just, you know, hiked out there, walked out there, strolled out there, ridden their ATVs out there. And then several years ago, I think it was in 2007, BLM found a new trail dug and whatnot and closed it off so to all motorized traffic. And now San Juan County, which is where Blanding is asking the BLM and have been asking the BLM for years to open up at least part of the canyon, reopen it for ATVs. So there are archaeological ruins in there. There are, you know, valuable archaeological sites. So that's why the BLM wants to close. So anyway, a county commissioner acting on his own, not for the commission, is inviting other ATV riders to ride with him in the canyon. And the BLM is warning them that they could face civil and criminal penalties. This ride is scheduled for a week from tomorrow, so that would be May 10th.
And meanwhile, in Washington, Representative Chris Stewart is criticizing the BLM for having a SWAT team, again, in reference to that standoff in Nevada with Cliven Bundy. Any end in sight to this federal oversight of public lands debate?
No.
That's
no,
a short
there
answer,
is no end
huh?
in
okay.
sight. And it comes back, it recurs. It's been mounting since the 60s, when a lot of environmental and laws that gave all of the American public more of a say in the lands started being passed. Environmental conservation laws, there are all sorts of them. Anyway, they started being passed that, and so since then, the agencies have been a lot more bureaucratic, other people like environmentalists, some of whom may not live in Utah, have a lot more say about those public lands. So anyway, the clashes have recurred, especially during Democratic administrations. There was a Sagebrush Rebellion in the 70s. There was the Wise Use Movement in the 90s, you know, Carter and Clinton, and now under Obama. There's this new one, and, it's not clear whether it will really turn into a west-wide movement, but it has that potential. And then there's also this parallel political thing going on where Representative Ken Ivey, Utah State Rep from West Jordan, is proposing a political solution, and that would be Utah, well, not just Utah, all the western states would take over the federal lands within their borders, not wilderness areas and national parks, but pretty much everything else. So there's a lot, and there's a lot going on. It's all over the West. There's another confrontation planned on the Salmon River in Idaho over gold mining. So I don't think it's going to die out anytime soon. This may be, I think it's still a rising level of animosity.
Kristen Moulton, I know you've got to get back to it. Thank you so much for your time today.
You bet.
Kristen Moulton of the Salt Lake Tribune. And if you want to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. Gail from Sugar House called in. She didn't want to be on the air, but she says she thinks that the Salt Lake City should use more natural gas buses instead of streetcars. Streetcars are too slow. Neighbors don't want it. It's an expensive infrastructure, and buses are more cost-effective. Chris Smart, how would Mayor Becker respond to those concerns, do you think?
Well, I think the first thing they would tell you is that it's the UTA that runs the buses, not Salt Lake City. Second is the fact that with the streetcars, the city can initiate these programs because it's their right of way. They put the rail in and they're leading out on trying to get funding. That said, there has been discussion in the council on sort of, I don't know what's the right word, using money, paying UTA extra money to provide extra bus service. And I think, so if you talk to the transportation director, Robin Hutchison, she would say, we want to move forward with buses and with streetcars. But I think the sentiment that your listener put forth here is a common one, because what people want to do is they want to get around now. They don't want to wait 10 years for the streetcar because they need to get to work now and elsewhere now. And, when you talk about the natural gas buses, it seems like a great transportation mode in terms of establishing it short term.
Gail, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. You can send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk or comments at sltrib.com. Let's switch over to Utopia, and I'm not talking about some idyllic universe. We're talking about the fiber optic network that cities have been struggling to install, have gone into a lot of debt for. An Australian company says that it wants to take over this Utopia project. And they're talking to public officials this week about their plan. What's the sales pitch of this company called Macquarie?
Well, they are akin to the Goldman Sachs of Australia. They're a big, and I mean big, investment and project management company with operations around the world. And they're proposing to the 11 Utopia member cities a model that, short acronym is PPP, a public-private partnership. And essentially, it's a kind of a concession to this private company. They would assume the business risks. They would float additional debt. They would hire, all of the construction and technical staff needed to build this network out in exchange for a 30-year contract, under which they would enjoy a certain proportion of the profits.
Here's a tweet coming in from Fringe. Why are the Aussies so interested in Utah? I guess that's the big question. People are like, why? Why do you want to take on this project? What do they say?
Well, it's a very interesting question. From Macquarie's perspective, they have, as I mentioned, global operations. They've been in the United States since about the mid-90s, primarily in the transportation sector. Mm. So big toll road projects, highway projects, bridges, this sort of thing. And telecommunications, in a way, especially in the United States, represents a certain diversification of their portfolio. So that's kind of the big picture. They're interested in being in lots of different kinds of projects, and they see public fiber broadband communications as the future. They've, done a couple of telecommunications towers projects in Asia and that sort of thing. But so this is a sector that they're interested in pursuing.
But they've never done it before anywhere else.
They've not done a fiber project in the United States, and in fact, this would be a first in their global portfolio, which, in a way represents them branching into new areas. Now, if you look at the Utopia footprint, it's a patchwork network. It's built at inconsistent levels between the 11 cities. But the infrastructure, the basic backbone is there. They've got a user base. Utopia's got a user base of about 63,000, which is less than half of what they could potentially have if it were fully built out on all the 11 cities. But I guess the short answer is Utopia is a good start as far as Macquarie is concerned. There have been execution problems, but the conception is sound as far as Macquarie's analysis is concerned. And they've been studying this. They've been kind of off the radar for a part of their look at taking this over. They were probably in this market late summer, last fall, kind of went public with an interest in a thorough study of it in December. And as of this week, they've reached the end of their first milestone, which is a thorough look at how viable this is. And they're taking it out to representatives from the 11 cities to see if they want to go the next round, which would be milestone two, which would be a thorough kind of business plan development and a kind of an initial financial picture of what it would look like to see if the cities want to go further.
Here's the kicker. The piece of this that real people are going to want to know about is they have to pay a little bit. There's a monthly fee in order to be part of this Utopia network.
Well, and not only that, but it's levied as it'd be like a tack onto your utility bill. So an additional $18 to $20 a month on your city utility bill.
Ouch.
And that's whether or not you take the basic service. And the basic service would be a three megabit upload and download broadband connection, which is, if you're a CenturyLink or a Comcast user now, is approximately akin to that. You might get some faster speeds depending on your vendor. For about $60 a month is what the commercial rate is right now. And yes, indeed, that is going to be the toughest selling point of all of this. Macquarie calls it an availability fee.
Hmm.
And having that locked in, as in a secure funding mechanism, is crucial to its vision of taking this to private lenders to make all this run. Now, just by way of background, over the course of Utopia's 11-year history, they've issued a significant number of bonds, and have encumbered sales taxes and franchise taxes from the member cities to the tune of about $500 million. And that's going to have to be paid off essentially no matter what, whether the network is closed, whether it's sold off in pieces, or whether it's made viable. And Macquarie's model really addresses the picture going forward. They're not going to take on any of this additional, any of this debt that the cities have incurred. They're basically going to build the network out and ideally, in a utopia, so to speak, they would build a cash flow that would more than pay for those municipal bonds.
The city leaders are loving this because it's a way out for them from this huge debt burden. But the Macquarie plan is has critics.
Yeah. Well, they have the, you know, cities are indeed enthusiastic about this. You know, just a little look at Utopia's governance. That is run by city officials from the 11 cities, and you've got scores of city officials that have been fighting to make this thing work, to make it get off the ground for, you know, literally a decade, and now they can actually see the light at the end of the tunnel. But over the course of those 11 years, they have irritated large segments of their constituencies by the fact that this bond debt is weighing city budgets down, that the network is not widely available, and in some cities the build-out is really quite small, and those cities are looking across the border and seeing cities that have a bigger build-out, so there's parity issues. You've got a lot of frustrated voters out there that are looking at now the possibility of having $20 tacked onto their bill, whether or not they take the service.
Sure.
Now, the vision here is still carrying enthusiasm in a lot of city halls forward, and that is for a fully wired fiber network that's delivering gigabit speeds, which is about 200 times what you can do with a standard connection now. They continue to see significant economic development benefits. There are cities that, you know, a limited number of cities that have networks like this. In Utah, bigger numbers nationally, obviously, and that do see some of those benefits. Some of that dream does actually come true, especially at the business end. You've got Utopia users, people that are actually able to get the service, that, you know, sing its praises widely. There continues to be this dream that this could actually happen, and along comes Macquarie with its own sort of business motives and wants to make this work for a lot of different reasons. And so it'll be very interesting to see how this debate plays out.
Sure. So who decides when would it happen if approved?
It instantly raises a lot of thorny questions. The cities have 60 days, whether, you know, to sort of vet this milestone and tell Macquarie whether or not they want to go forward. My hunch is that not all 11 will go for it. Maybe they will, I don't know. You have a core in some cities of city officials that have run and been elected on platforms that directly oppose further Utopia financing. They want the cities out. So there's going to be resistance there. The question becomes, you know, if you have a group of cities that do go for it, some that don't, what happens to the residual network?
Right. How does Macquarie take that?
And how does Macquarie deal with all of that? Macquarie's saying it doesn't have a specific threshold of cities that need to buy in for it to want to go forward. It's kind of favoring adjacency. That is, the technical network's a little easier to build if you have cities that are close together that kind of go for it. And there are some big players like West Valley City, and that, you know, that are obviously more attractive. But Macquarie wants to do this, and you know, they're big boys on public-private partnerships. They kind of know the public part of it pretty well, and they're going to throw this into the arena of democracy and see where it goes.
Interesting. We're speaking with Tony Semerad from the Salt Lake Tribune. Also with us, Chris Smart and Robert Gerke, talking about the week's news. And you're invited to chime in as well. 801-355-TALK is our number. Put your comments at sltrib.com. We'll be right back after another quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune, and joining me in studio, Chris Smart, Robert Gerke, and Tony Semerad, talking about the week's headlines. And you're welcome to join us as well, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. You can send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk, or you can put your comments at sltrib.com. Looks like we've got Pete Ashdown on the line from X Mission, and I should mention that he is an underwriter of KCPW in the full interest of disclosure. And Pete, good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you. My nose is tingling, and so I thought I should call in.
All right. What's going on?
Well, I wanted to underscore an important aspect of the Macquarie proposal and Utopia, and in that it encourages competition. It's an open network that any provider, Comcast, CenturyLink, and Google included, can come on and utilize to provide service to customers. And I think this is important because competition is what drives service. It drives price, and it also protects net neutrality. The whole debate about net neutrality, because of what Comcast has been doing with Netflix and, in essence, holding them over a barrel, is happening because Comcast has no competition in most of their service areas. They're able to do this because people have no alternative. What is unique about Macquarie's proposal and Utopia is that if a internet service provider was trying to hold Netflix over the barrel, the customers could switch to another internet service provider. And I think this is important because right now Salt Lake City announced that they've completed the Google Fiber checklist and they're moving forward with investigating Google Fiber. Google Fiber, if we install that in Salt Lake City, is going to be another service monopoly. No other fiber provider in their right mind would go in and lay a parallel fiber network to challenge Google, because Google has an immense amount of resources, and I worry about that in the long run. I mean, in the short run, it's going to be great to have Google Fiber here as an alternative, but in the long run, they could be another Comcast.
All right, Pete, we got to move on, but thanks for the call. And Tony, just briefly, your response?
Well, Pete does raise an interesting element of the Macquarie plan. It would remain an open network, and it would be a wholesale network in that ISPs would be able to come in and sell their services. And that, I think, in addition to maybe making sense from a business model perspective, there are about 18 ISPs on Utopia's network now. Macquarie says it wants more, and that would indeed encourage competition. I also think it serves to meet at least part of the way some of the anti-competitive concerns in the legislature that have dogged Utopia from the beginning. I mean, the big utilities of the world have lobbied heavily both at the legislature and at municipal government level, to essentially hinder Utopia's development, or at least, assert certain competitive interests from the private sector. And I think Macquarie has rightly recognized that, it just purely from a PR perspective, in addition to a business model perspective, it needs to keep that open wholesale nature of the network if it's got a prayer of making this fly.
Mm. Just very, very briefly, because this is a story that Salt Lake Tribune has been following for well over a year, some new information, new tapes obtained by the newspaper, a conversation between former Utah Attorney General Mark Shurtleff and Jeremy Johnson. Robert Gerke, what do these recordings reveal?
Well, it's a pretty dramatic meeting. It's Jeremy Johnson going in to meet with Mark Shurtleff to discuss the indictments he's facing for fraud relating to the operation of his iWorks business. And it's about an hour and 20 minutes long. I could have brought excerpts. You can go on sltrib.com and listen to some of them. It starts out with, Jeremy kind of presenting his grievances against the federal government about this case. And then you've got the sitting attorney general, meeting with a major campaign contributor, advising him on how to deal with criminal indictments he's facing. It's dramatic in that sense. And then there's a period in the meeting where Jeremy kind of has this emotional breakdown. He's afraid he's going to be going to prison, not seeing his kids, leaving them fatherless. And Shurtleff expresses concerns that Jeremy might be contemplating suicide. He makes him kind of commit to him that he's not going to do anything rash, and mm-hmm. and that's an emotional period. And then at the very tail end of it, Shurtleff offers to go talk to the U.S. attorney, not disclosing that he's talking to the U.S. attorney on Jeremy's behalf, but go talk to the U.S. attorney and try to advise him that there are the prosecutors in the office that are treating Jeremy unfairly. So he's kind of offering to go to bat for him. It's not clear whether that meeting took place. We don't think it did. But all in all, it's about an hour and 20 minutes long. It's a fairly remarkable meeting. It's something we've been trying to get for months and months, and now we've got I think it's safe to assume that the criminal prosecutors have copies of this. The House investigators had copies of this as well. So, but this is the first time we've heard it.
Well, good work to you and our colleague Tom Harvey. And again, it's interesting that Jeremy Johnson denies a couple of times that he's actually taping when we know that he did because we're listening to it. Yeah. Check it out, sltrib.com. Want to go quickly to the underplayed story of the week. And Tony, do you have something?
Well, you know, one that interests me, it wasn't exactly underplayed because it was on the front page of the Tribune, but I'm continuing to watch this NSA water bill.
And yes,
as dull as that sounds, our reporter Nate Carlisle, after just months of work, managed to get the Utah Data Center's water usage numbers, the facility down in Bluffdale, the National Security Agency facility. And, you know, I don't know about anybody else, but I'm seeing a pretty interesting pattern there. The water use, it's a water, water demand is very high at that facility for cooling purposes and that sort of a thing. And we've known that going in. Water usage kind of ramped up last summer as it was sort of following a timeline of bringing that massive computing and data storage facility online. And then it has dropped off fairly significantly. And that seems to kind of match up with some other reporting of technical difficulties they've had in launching that site. They are now paying for more water than they're using. And, you know, NSA, obviously a very secretive agency, not telling us exactly why they haven't, you know, trumpeted the opening of that facility as they'd promised to do in the fall. I think there may be another story or set of stories there about whether that facility is actually going to get off the ground.
Anything with NSA, very secretive. Love it. Robert, what's your pick?
Let's throw a couple at you real quick. The 85,000 people almost signed up for Obamacare in March, which I think was much more than they anticipated. Mm-hmm. The population of Utah is supposed to double by 2050, which is going to completely shake up everything we've talked about today. I mean,
yeah,
that's sort of the fundamental. But the one that hits me closest to home, I think, is Salt Lake City and Casey Jarman, who organized the Twilight Concert Series, the Living Traditions Festival, and the Brown Bag Concert Series has parted ways, I guess, Chris could explain that a little bit more, but parted ways with the city over creative differences, and that's he's brought a lot of great things to Salt Lake City, and it, I think, will be missed.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, Chris, you can't explain because we only have a minute, so give me your top pick, unless you want to explain.
Well,
use your 30 seconds wisely.
Well, my underplayed story was a ruling out of the Tenth Circuit on the RS-2477 ruling, which this goes back 25 years, where counties in Utah have been suing the feds over historic right-of-ways that go back to pioneer times. It's more of the sagebrush rebellion that we've been talking about, and it lends itself, it's just part and parcel of this this political stance on the right that we're going to take this land back from the federal government, and it's a litmus test practically like gun rights or abortion. And it's just, it's, you know, that's who we are.
I'm going to have to leave my sleeper story on the table because we're out of time. Chris Smart and Tony Semerad and Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks, everybody.
Hey, thanks.
Thank you.
We'll wrap up today's program with a conversation with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, who discovered something called the special officer.
I was going through old newspapers in the Tribune and came across this thing where the police department, Salt Lake City Police Department, had gone around and made special officers for all the churches that were along South Temple.
Why is this?
Because people kept getting hit by cars on Sunday going to services. They were jaywalking across the street, or even if they were in, say, a crosswalk, although I don't know if they had them back then, cars were running over them. And they were losing like 2 to 3 people a year.
Wow. So way, in order to get people safely to and from church.
Just like an elementary school, they made crossing guards and they called them special officers. I've never had a church job that I wanted so badly.
And why would you want this job, Robert?
Well, you keep people out of church by not letting them cross the street.
I love it. I love it. But you have not been deputized because this program no longer exists.
No, they finally stopped doing it. I'm not exactly sure when, but at the time that this was going on, which was in the 1940s, it was a pretty big deal.
You wrote a column about this in 2010. Maybe you can read about this sort of imaginary exchange that you had.
I wanted to be one of these special officers, and so I imagined it as a ward calling in the LDS Church. You know, the bishop would call you in and say, "We're calling you to be a special officer." And I said, "I can see exactly how this would have worked in an LDS ward and why it didn't last, Bishop. And so, Brother Wapp, the Lord is calling you to be a special officer. Brother Wapp, woohoo, where's my badge?" The first month probably went well. Humbled by the responsibility, the ward special officer would have been out there helping old ladies and making sure little kids didn't run into the road. But all power corrupts. By the second month, things would have started to go wrong. The ward special officer would be standing in the middle of the street wearing shades and saying, "Come on, move along, nothing to see here." Well into the third or fourth month, the ward special officer would have been asking people for ID and patting them down before letting them pray.
If this program were in place today, how would you execute that?
Well, first of all, there would be capital punishment, like you just said, you know, execution. Yeah, for felony jaywalking. I don't know. I mean, it's still an issue today. We have tons of people crossing back and forth the church office building and the temple square, but I'm not sure I'd want to be in charge today. This requires the enthusiasm of a really young guy.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can find his columns on the website, sltrib.com, and hear him each week here on Behind the Headlines. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. The show is produced by the Salt Lake Tribune with help from Jesse Ellis and Tyler Ford. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Thanks for listening.